Welcome to Osteopathy Unplugged. I'm Steve Paulus, DO.
And I'm Bonnie Gintis, DO. We're American osteopathic physicians, and we're a married couple devoted to the practice and the study of osteopathic medicine.
Join us as we sit in conversation, talking about the inner and outer workings of osteopathy. Hey, Bon, what's the topic of today's episode?
Today's episode will be a continuation of the answer to the foundational question, what is osteopathy? We've organized the next few episodes to answer this important question. The last episode was an introduction to the question where we laid some of the foundation by defining important terms, but we didn't really answer the bigger question. In today's episode, we will address osteopathic philosophy. In the next episode, episode 4, we'll be addressing the principles of treatment. And in the 5th episode, we'll be talking about the osteopathic ways of being, the role of the inner life of the osteopath. Steve, you organized the key concepts of osteopathic philosophy and the principles of treatment based on 3 decades of your own research. It's been incredible living with you in more ways than one, and seeing how you've sifted through the material and organized Andrew Taylor Still's writings to distill the core foundational principles. And then, as with everything important in our life, we talked about it over our morning hot brown liquids. So can you tell our listeners a little bit about what you've discovered?
So let me give our listeners a little bit of an understanding of my process and how I developed the philosophy of osteopathy as 10 core concepts and how ultimately I developed then the principles of osteopathic treatment. After reading each of Still's books, I underlined, highlighted quotes, wrote in margins like they were workbooks, flagged, tagged, labeled sections with post-it notes. My copies of Still's 4 books are an organized mess. In the mid-1990s, I scanned all 4 of A.T. Still's written works, allowing me to search the books for quotes that progressed, allowing me to see recurring patterns. I then identified recurring keywords and themes, allowing me to develop a more thorough delineation of osteopathic philosophy. A.T. Still was either a disorganized genius or was crazy like a fox. He did not hand to us on a silver platter the philosophy of osteopathy, and therefore a collection of osteopathic principles of treatment. In my opinion, he hid them in plain sight. He scattered a very elegant philosophy throughout his writings, waiting and hoping that someone someday would unveil the obvious. Still was dogged in his pursuit of understanding of the human condition in health and in disease. And I became dogged in my pursuit of the recurring patterns, allowing for me to reveal his distinct and exquisite philosophy of osteopathy. So let me end my introduction to this episode by clearly articulating what osteopathy is and it is not. First, osteopathy is a clinical philosophy that informs patient care. Second, an osteopathic treatment is an activity that promotes healing. Third, osteopathy is more than a theory. It is a practice, a devotion to detail, and a way of perceiving the human body in health and in disease.
Ah, so beautifully said. However, you left out an important acknowledgement I want to make before we move on.
Tell me.
Okay, our friend Nick Handel, a British osteopath, he pointed out years ago when he read one of the early versions of your long list of principles that there were actually 2 distinct categories. He separated philosophical principles from principles of treatment. And then as we further sorted them out, we realized there was a 3rd category that deserved distinction, and that category is the osteopathic ways of being. That's how what we're discussing got divvied up the way we're presenting it to you all. So here's what we're going to do in this episode. Steve will read each one of the 10 philosophical concepts. One or both of us will offer a quote or two from Andrew Taylor Still, and we'll discuss each one of those quotes and bring it into a modern context. You don't need to take notes. The print version of these principles will be available on our website, osteopathyunplugged.com. Today's episode is just an introduction to these principles to give you the big picture. Most of these important philosophical concepts are going to have their own episode. So let's start with number one. Steve, tell us about the first principle, holism.
Human beings function in a dynamic state of holism, or what Andrew Taylor Still called connected oneness.
Andrew Taylor Still said, and I quote, "We look at the body and health as meaning perfection and harmony, not in one part, but as the whole." Steve, give us a list of key words you discovered when he was talking about this idea of holism.
So I've identified 18 overlapping key words that are synonyms for holism that permeate all of his writings. He used these alternative words and phrases for what is now called holism hundreds of times in his published writings. These key words and phrases are, and I'm going to start with my favorite, which is connected oneness.
Oh, that's my favorite too.
The rest include harmony, harmonious combination, mechanical harmony, complete in form, the universality of the fascia, the human body as a whole, the body functioning united, the whole system, the whole with harmonious action, the whole body, the whole being, the common whole, the whole system, perfection and harmony of the whole body, united in form, man in his completed form, and normal equilibrium. I think it's important for us to remember that the term holism wasn't coined as a word until 1926 by the South African philosopher J.C. Smuts in his book, Holism and Evolution, and was not made famous really until the 1960s. Holism is ultimately based upon Aristotle's philosophy of the whole is greater than the sum of its parts. The concept of holism is in essence a law of nature. It is the ecologic expression of equilibrium for human beings integrated with their environment. Holism is not a theory. Holism is a law of nature. Holism is the ultimate expression of health and is defined by connection. Disease is disconnection and is a diminished expression of holism. The presence or absence of holism can be perceived by the osteopath with our hands via the complexity of palpation. The presence or absence of holism is a diagnostic tool utilized by the osteopath during the elaborate process of an osteopathic treatment. So, Bon, how do you experience holism in the context of osteopathy?
So I'd like to add one important point in my worldview. Holism is a principle of complex systems, and the living human body is the ultimate complex system. And we live in relationship to another complex system, the natural world. So what is a complex system? A complex system is something that is open and adaptive and able to self-organize. So healing, which we'll be talking about a lot, healing is a specialized form of self-organization that unfolds over time and through relationship between the body and its environment. And in the context of an osteopathic treatment, part of the environment that the body is living in includes the osteopath. So this is a really interesting, complex, interconnected system.
That's quite well said.
Thank you. So this leads us to the next principle. So Steve, tell us about the second principle. Health.
The objective in osteopathic treatment is not just to identify and treat disease, but to find what is healthy and utilize the biologic field of health both diagnostically and in treatment to actively engage a therapeutic process. Arguably, the most famous and profound of all of A.T. Still's quotes is, and I quote, "To find health should be the object of the doctor. Anyone can find disease."
So many of you may be asking, I've heard this a million times, and I quote this myself, and I'm always wondering, what does this actually mean? So what does it mean to use health as a reference point? Well, I wrote a whole chapter on the subject in my book, so you could, in your spare time, go check it out there. But in the meantime, I'll give you a summary. We hold the biologic field of health with all of its creative possibilities that are available in a healthy system rather than just hunting for what's wrong when we treat somebody. In my view, an effective osteopath identifies what's right in their patient before determining what's wrong. It's this point of reference that I think makes osteopaths distinctive. I've studied a lot of different approaches to healthcare, and I have never found this orientation to the health, to what's right in a person, in any other approach to healthcare. The closest thing I've actually found is the concept of original nature from Zen Buddhism, but we're not going to be getting into that in this episode. Steve, talk to us about your definition of health.
I'd like to formally define health as a distinctive biologic matrix within a living being that interfaces with every aspect of structure, with all of the physiologic processes, and with the totality of all psychologic states, both conscious and unconscious. It is the milieu, the growth medium, or the nutritional source of what we call the therapeutic process. The recognition of health as a reference point and the origin of healing is what makes osteopathy distinct from all other healing arts and sciences. Conceptually, healing is simple. And for simplicity, I utilize a mathematical analogy. The math of healing is health plus disease equals healing. However, we all know that in practice, healing is wildly complex. So let me just end by giving you two key concepts regarding the health. And we must always remember these two key points. Healing emerges from what is healthy in the body, not from what is diseased. And healing is the action that emerges from the health.
I just want to add one thing, because in my experience, I've met way too many osteopaths who misinterpret this principle as a directive to just be with the health. Like, if that's all you do, you've done your job. I think what makes our approach so powerful is that we can hold the health while simultaneously making a diagnosis. We can do both.
So I agree that some osteopaths misinterpret the issue of health and exclusively engage the health without recognizing the disease. And if we really follow what I said earlier about mathematical formula of healing, you need to bring health to the disease or disease to the health for healing to occur. And that's what an osteopathic treatment is.
And that leads us seamlessly into the third concept of self-healing. Steve, tell us about self-healing.
The goal of an osteopathic manipulative treatment is to enhance the natural ability to self-heal by augmenting the local and global health of the body by removing the obstructions to normal structure and function. An osteopathic manipulative treatment helps to create the best possible conditions for self-healing to occur.
So I'm going to offer some quotes from Andrew Taylor Still. And I quote, "Nature has no apology to offer. It does the work. If you know how to line up the parts, then food and rest are all that is required." He also said, "When we take up the principles, we get down to nature. It is ever-willing, self-caring, self-feeding, and self-protecting."
A.T. Still used the broad term nature to refer to all of the self-healing structures and processes in the body. By using nature as an all-encompassing term, he was including all of the material forms of healing that were known of at the time and the non-material elements of healing that were in the realm of the unknown. What we generically call self-healing has many synonyms in Still's jargon, as well as in our modern terminology. Why don't you give us some examples of these synonyms for self-healing?
Sure. So A.T. Still used a lot of hyphenated words that started with self: self-caring, self-feeding, self-protecting, self-repair, self-regulation. And in a more modern context, we would add words like equilibrium, homeostasis, or allostasis. I want to offer another quote from Still. He also said, and I quote, "The first step in osteopathy is a belief in our own bodies." I love this quote, and to me, this describes the whole situation that sets the context for people coming for treatment. People come to us when they aren't healing on their own. They're stuck, and often they've lost trust in their own ability to self-heal. They come to us thinking that we can heal them. But as the osteopath G.D. Hewlett said in 1904, cure is the prerogative of the organism. No one heals another person. Can I say that again to make it clear? No one heals another person. I cringe when I hear somebody who calls themselves a healer. We as osteopaths create the conditions for our patients' bodies to heal themselves. And sometimes we also need to hold the trust in their ability to do so. Frequently, the patient who's suffering needs to experience some degree of healing or change in their body so that they can restore trust in their own ability to self-heal. Now I'm going to quote the great 20th century osteopath Stanley Shiawitz, who used to say, all of osteopathic philosophy is contained in the A.T. Still quote, find it, fix it, and leave it alone. In this quote, though, everyone puts the emphasis on the wrong part. People tend to focus on the fix-it part, thinking that the treatment is the most important. He liked to stress the precision that we need to diagnose, and then we need to have the trust to leave it alone, knowing that healing is possible. The treatment is actually the easiest part of the equation. The primal force of change is self-healing, and it cannot be opposed from outside forces. This is such a huge topic. In the future, we'll have a whole episode on this subject. But I'm sure, Steve, you have more to say. So what else should we tell our listeners about self-healing?
Well, you know how I love taking a still quote or a quote from somebody else and then rephrasing it into a modern context. So I'd like to take an earlier still quote of yours and rephrase that to say, the first step in the process of healing is a trust in our own bodies. Mm-hmm. And that key concept is essential because, as you said, frequently a patient will lose trust in themselves. They'll lose trust in their natural ability to self-heal. They'll lose trust in the natural world that is inside their body. And we as osteopaths access the natural ability to self-heal. And so temporarily, the patient trusts that we trust in their natural ability to self-heal until they can re-engage their greater faith and trust or belief in their ability to self-heal. But I want to go back to the quote from Hewlett.
Okay.
Because he's one of my favorite osteopathic authors, where he said, cure is the prerogative of the organism. I've changed that quote to be more exact, to say, healing is not the prerogative of the osteopath. Mm-hmm. Let's go back to Stan. Mm-hmm. So Stan is your original mentor back from medical school.
Yes, he was my first osteopathic teacher.
And he was my last osteopathic teacher.
We're the alpha and the omega here.
Yes. So Stan often rephrased the still quote, find it, fix it, leave it alone. And he would tell me emphatically and repeatedly, find it, fix it, and get out of the way. According to Stan, the most important parts of an osteopathic treatment are an accurate diagnosis, or to find it, and the final action, to leave it alone. Or more specifically, for the osteopath to get out of the way of the patient's self-healing process. Shiawitz emphatically emphasized that the osteopath is not doing the work of healing, but often an overzealous osteopath can try to do too much and can inhibit the self-healing mechanisms of leave it alone.
Right. And in a future episode, when we talk about that, I have some great stories for you.
Oh, I love Stan stories.
Yes. All right. I think it's time to move on to the fourth concept, where we'll talk about the mind-body, body-mind relationship.
The body and psyche are interdependent and inseparable in disease and in health. Both have the ability to self-heal in the presence of disease, injury, illness, or other challenges.
The mind-body connection is not directly a part of A.T. Still's teaching, but the mind-body connection is an important part of the evolution of osteopathy. It's important to understand that the word mind meant something different in the 19th century than it does today. In a holistic worldview where we're in a state of connected oneness, there is no hierarchy of body or mind. If we're treating the whole, then the person is going to respond as a whole. So although AT still may not have discussed psychological issues, you know, that concept didn't even exist in the early days of osteopathy yet. The first osteopathic school opened in 1892. Psychology didn't emerge as a separate approach until the late 1800s, early 1900s. William James, who's considered the father of American psychology, published his first book in 1890. Freud published his first book in 1901. So this idea of the importance of the psychology of a person had not made its way to the American frontier of Kansas and Missouri. But what we think of as the mind-body or the body-mind connection is congruent with his philosophy.
When we really look at Still's work practically, he did include the mind-body, body-mind inquiry into his clinical work. After he died, the American School of Osteopathy asked that patients, friends, students, and practicing DOs send to the school their stories of Dr. Still. Hundreds of letters were sent detailing the interpersonal stories of Andrew Taylor Still. They're collectively known as the Remembrances of A.T. Still, and they remain unpublished. I've read every known story about Still and have found that in these stories, he respected and addressed what we now call the mind-body connection. It was through his actions, not via his written works, that he demonstrated his understanding of the complexity of what it meant to be a human being. I would like to end with a quote from my own writings that best exemplifies the coexistence and the inextricable connection between the mind-body or body-mind. The same forces of healing that fix a broken bone mend a broken heart.
Oh, I have a visceral response when you say that. It rings so true to me. I feel it in my heart. I feel it in my gut. I feel it in my bones.
You're such a great osteopath.
Oh, all right. Thank you, Steve. Steve, let's move on to the fifth concept, the structure-function interrelationship.
The relationship between structure and function impacts the overall health of the entire body. Structure, or anatomy, and function, or physiology, are interdependent and inseparable in disease and in health. Restoration of normal structure and function forms one of the foundations of osteopathic manipulative treatment.
So A.T. Still never used the exact words that are often used in modern times. Structure and function are reciprocally interrelated. This is that phrase that's in those four undemanding concepts that are listed by the American Osteopathic Association. But he did use the words, and I quote, equilibrium of form and function. Steve, can you tell us more about how he used that word equilibrium?
I love the word equilibrium. He said that structure and function are in equilibrium, and structure and function exist in a dynamic relationship. Equilibrium is a biologic process. By including equilibrium in the definition, we are multidimensional and biologic rather than two-dimensional and semantically confusing.
But Steve, equilibrium has to be more than just being interrelated, right? You can be interrelated and out of balance. So the relationship we're talking about is dynamic, and it's constantly responding in both directions. So I think in order to understand the larger context of what I'm talking about here, I want to talk about a problem that shades our thinking on this. We live in a material culture, and materialism has defined Western medicine, and objectification of the body is the glitch at the center of the spiral. The body is not a thing. The body is a process. But in our form-obsessed culture, where the size and the shape of the body is often valued more than how it works, we forget that the relationship goes both ways, and it's constantly shifting. We don't want to objectify static anatomy at the exclusion of dynamic physiology. There are too many examples in our profession that refer to primarily structural problems. So let's give our listeners some examples of both, starting with primarily functional problems, as well as giving them some primary structural problem.
Let me give you a couple examples from my experience. The first case history is a 35-year-old female who is a passenger in a car that's involved in a motor vehicle accident. She suffers a severe sprain of her right wrist, which is her dominant hand, and is placed in a splint for 3 weeks. During this time, she must alter her function by overutilizing her non-dominant left hand and thus develops an elbow tendonitis on the left side. The cause of her left elbow tendonitis is a change in the function that leads to a structural defect on the left side.
Great example.
Let me give you another example. An 8-year-old boy gets into an argument with his parents. He's angry, and he storms out of the house to escape, gets on his bicycle, races down the driveway, and crashes into a tree, fracturing his leg. His functional disturbance is anger, and anger was the cause of his fractured leg.
I love that consideration of the emotional underpinning of a situation being the functional disturbance.
We oftentimes ignore the emotional field in both a medical and in an osteopathic context.
And we will be talking about that later on when we introduce some new concepts. I want to give you another example of a situation that starts with an alteration of function. So remember, the way you use your body influences its structure, and the structure of your body can also influence the way you use it. So it goes both ways. But in this situation, let's talk about someone who comes into the office with a complaint of pain in their elbow from playing tennis. We actually call this lateral epicondylitis tennis elbow. And you might assume that that's a structural problem. But if this problem unfolded because this tennis player used their dominant side incorrectly, it's actually more correct to view it as a functional problem. So the most effective treatment for tennis elbow, according to Stan Shiawitz, would not be an osteopathic treatment, but a tennis lesson. So in this situation, the suffering tennis player might need to go to their tennis pro and learn a new way to grip their racket or learn the proper way to swing the racket. Maybe they need a new racket that has a different diameter handle. They might need to do some targeted exercises. And then, of course, an osteopathic treatment would be helpful to address the tissue dysfunction. I'm going to give you one more example. The functional dysfunction of the 21st century is about posture. So in this day and age, we all sit at computers a little bit too much. We look down at our phones. And what happens to the body? We encourage a thoracic kyphosis. We end up compressing our entire spine. There's a ripple effect. Some people get tension headaches, low back pain. You can even get a visceral disturbance, gastroesophageal reflux, due to a postural change. Here's another example, and this is an interesting example because this one can go in multiple directions. So let's say we have a person who thinks they're experiencing anxiety, a lot of stress, and they've decided to label the experience that they have intermittently as a panic disorder. So there are a lot of assumptions one could make about what that might be. But in this situation, this person has increased cortisol, they have surges of norepinephrine and epinephrine in their system. Symptoms can range from muscle tightness to cardiac arrhythmias. They can end up with an altered metabolism, with deposition of visceral fat that causes all sorts of other problems. And they can end up in an increased inflammatory state. So let's say I'm going to describe two situations. One person goes to the emergency room, reports to the emergency doctor that they're experiencing a panic attack, and upon examination, they listen to their heart, they hook them up to an EKG, and it turns out that they're actually having a cardiac arrhythmia. Let's say something like Wolff-Parkinson-White syndrome, where basically the electrical wiring of the heart is acting like a frayed wire. The treatment for this problem is either ablating the nerve or giving them a medication to blunt the hyper-responsiveness of their heart. And guess what? Suddenly, this person who thought they were having panic attacks is not having them anymore. They had a structural problem in their heart that was corrected, and their panicky situation went away. They were actually misinterpreting the physiologic response of their body. But let's say another person who thinks they're having panic attack goes to the emergency room on that same night. They think there's an epidemic of panic in the town, which unfortunately these days there might be. And after a really thorough workup, the emergency room physician gives them the advice, you need to go back to your family doctor and get a referral to psychotherapy. And this person might discover in the long run that what they really had going on was some unresolved issues in their life that were stressing their system. Now, in both situations, as usual, an osteopathic treatment, since we treat the whole, will help both of these people to adapt creatively as well as they can to the situation they've found themselves in. Okay, Steve, let's move on to the sixth philosophical concept of normal.
To fully understand abnormal conditions, disease, injury, or illness, the structure and function of what is normal for human beings in general and for each patient in particular must be understood. Normal is one expression of health.
So I'd like to offer a Andrew Taylor Still quote, and I quote, "When you know the differences between the normal and the abnormal structure, you have learned the all-absorbing first question, that you must take your abnormal case back to the normal, lay it down, and be satisfied to leave it. Thus, it is far better to familiarize your eye and your hand with the normal before you can approach the abnormal intelligently." So this quote is a riff on the principle of health. So as you stated in the principle, Steve, normal is one expression of health. In this quote, Still said, you must take your abnormal case back to the normal. In reality, the opposite's also true. We also take the normal to the abnormal. It's a two-way street from a treatment perspective. I was taught to bring the part back into relationship with the whole, as well as inviting the whole to the part. Both are legitimate and important approaches to integrate into the way you see things.
And we do that based upon that individual patient's necessity. Sometimes we bring the part to the whole for a person, and the next patient, we may bring the whole to the part. So it's a part of the individualized process of what an osteopathic treatment is in recognizing what each individual patient needs in that moment.
Right. And you coined a term that I totally love, and I use it all the time. I don't give you credit. I want to give you credit right now.
Okay.
You always say that one of the things we do with our patients is we address the necessity of the moment. Okay, Steve, you have a great story about Give Me 100 that I think really illustrates the normal concept really well. Can you tell us that story?
Sure. So when I was a second-year osteopathic medical student, I volunteered to work in a health fair sponsored by my university. The health fair was free to the public and offered blood pressure screenings, cholesterol testing, glaucoma pressure checks, scoliosis exams, hernia evaluations for men, and many other health screenings. Several hundred people signed up, and the health fair took place on two consecutive Saturdays. I chose to do the hernia exams, and I worked with a general surgeon. I had very little physical exam experience other than doing musculoskeletal structural exams in my osteopathic manipulation classes. The surgeon was a great teacher. He reviewed with me the anatomy of the inguinal canal and then walked me through an inguinal canal examination. We then did 10 normal examinations on patients together, him first, me second, and he guided me in my approach and technique. Once he was certain that I had the basics, he let me work on my own. But I was anxious and revealed to him that I didn't know what an inguinal hernia felt like, since I had only examined 10 normal men who did not have one. He said, "Once you give me 100 normals, an abnormal will slap you in the face."
Oh, what an image.
For the next 100 patients, I would see them in one section of the exam area, and he would check my results next door. During that time, I identified 5 abnormal inguinal canals. He then double-checked and confirmed that 3 were true hernias and were obvious, and 2 were a pre-hernia or a thinning of the abdominal wall called an impulse.
Oh, what a great thing to learn how to sense. A thinning of the abdominal wall that precedes the development of a hernia.
Exactly.
Right. If you learn to feel that in your patients, you can warn them about, you know, lifting heavy objects or things that might turn their thin or thinned abdominal wall into a hernia. What a great learning.
It was a great experience. Mm-hmm. Let me finish.
Okay.
At this point, he declared me competent, and he let me examine the next 150 patients on my own without checking my work. During this time, he found a dozen hernias in his group of patients and called me over to let me examine these men, giving me more abnormal exam experience. And I found 10 more that he confirmed by double-checking. Over the 2 weekends, I examined over 500 men, therefore examining over 1,000 inguinal canals, since there is a right and a left side.
Do the math.
Ever since then, I used the rule of 100, or I need 100 normal examinations whenever I discover a new anatomic region that can be addressed osteopathically. I search for the varieties of normal before I am confident that I can truly understand abnormal.
There are so many examples of other things that we learned in our both our medical and our osteopathic training where we were taught this way. This is so valuable. And I just want to thank all of the patients who allow us to examine them and learn from them. So let's move on to the seventh philosophical concept, anatomy. Steve, tell us about it.
A precise anatomic diagnosis is made using hands-on palpation of the body. A detailed anatomic diagnosis is clinically relevant and utilized to design a patient-specific, dynamic, osteopathic manipulative treatment plan. Let me give you a quote from Still that I think will help exemplify this. And I quote, "The osteopath must remember that his first lesson is anatomy, his last lesson is anatomy, and all of his lessons are anatomy."
I want to add a quote that's a variation on that one. Andrew Taylor Still also said, and I quote, "In early life, I began the study of anatomy, believing it to be the alpha and omega, the beginning and the end of all forms and the laws that give forms." So allow me to rephrase that A.T. Still quote. "In early life, I began the study of connected oneness, believing it to be the alpha and omega." In a couple of minutes, I'm going to be tying together the study of anatomy and connected oneness, so you'll understand why I replaced that word. But let's dive a little bit deeper. Steve, give us another A.T. Still quote before we move on.
Okay, let me give you another passage, and I quote, "An up-to-date osteopath must have a masterful knowledge of anatomy and physiology."
And one more quote from A.T. Still, "A knowledge of anatomy is only a dead weight if we do not know how to apply that knowledge with successful skill." So I think it's important to pause for a moment. I want to say a few words about particularly the word anatomy. The word anatomy is derived from the meaning to cut up. The word anatomy was coined by the early pioneers of medicine who began doing dissections. So originally the word meant to cut up and study the body in pieces. But what we must remember, especially in our modern day and age, is that we don't just cut things up and consider the parts. We must put them back together. And not only do we need to put the parts of the body structurally back together and imagine the anatomy as a whole, we have to combine it with its function, its physiology. And I have learned to appreciate physiology so much more deeply because I live with Steve, who is essentially a physiologist at the foundation of all. Physiology is the dynamic process that reminds us that the structure is alive and it's functioning in a constant state of shifting relationships. So there's a small but vocal segment of osteopaths who are more, let's say, energetically oriented in their approach to healthcare. And the most infamous statement I've heard from some of these osteopaths is that anatomy gets in their way of seeing God. I have to say, I disagree with them supremely.
And you know, it just makes me cringe.
Yes.
Because even making that statement is fundamentally anti-osteopathic.
I agree, and here's why. I would actually say the opposite, that anatomy is a manifestation of that which is greater than us. And in my opinion, the anatomy is the palpable, visible evidence of the unknowable and the unseen forces that are at work in the mystery of the living human body. So knowing detail anatomy, for me, this leads to a doorway. And in this doorway, I can pull aside one of the many veils or layers of my perceptual field. And what's revealed then is what is perceivable beyond the form. A.T. Still was not religious, but he saw the divine in anatomy. When he said one of his other famous one-liners, and I quote, "To know all of a bone in its entirety would close both ends of an eternity." This was his way of reminding us that attending to the specifics of anatomy can become part of our spirituality and our sense of connected oneness. To ignore anatomy is to deny the presence of the great mystery of life. Anatomy is the way to understanding and experiencing connected oneness. But you must know it. You must know the anatomy if you want to choose to drop it from your perceptual field. So if you want to filter it out, you have to know what it is that you're filtering. It's like working with the ego. If you want to shed your ego, you have to develop it first in order to be empowered to let it go. Later on, we'll do a complete episode on material and non-material approaches, and we will explore this in a lot more detail.
I just want to say that was very eloquently and wonderfully said.
Thank you, Steve.
I'd like to make an essential point in conclusion regarding the totality of osteopathic philosophy. Osteopathy is a hands-on healing art. There is no osteopathy unless we use our thinking, feeling, seeing, and knowing hands to make physical and metaphysical contact with our patients. There is no osteopathy unless we touch a patient using osteopathic manipulation. Osteopathy is devoted to anatomic specificity and to perceptual specificity. The more specific your understanding of functional anatomy, the better the results in an osteopathic treatment.
Well, that's a great segue into our eighth philosophical concept, where we'll be able to take this idea of perceptual specificity one notch further. So, Steve, tell us about the eighth principle, the material and the non-material.
There are two distinct and interrelated ways of perceiving during osteopathic diagnosis and treatment. The material field is tangible and contains the biomechanical elements that are formed by the palpable anatomy and physical functions that are objective and can be measured. The non-material field is invisible and refers to the subjective bioenergetic elements that underlie the material form. The non-material field is the expression of subtle functions or inherent forces. The material and non-material fields coexist simultaneously and are unified in a dynamic state of connected oneness.
So I'd like to offer some Andrew Taylor Still quotes on the subject, and I quote, "At this time, we begin to reason thus, that all powers are invisible and we see effect only. We know such forces to be abundant in nature, and life is sustained by them." He also said, and I quote, "Does nature have a finer matter that is invisible and that moves all that is visible to us? Life surely is a very finely prepared substance, which is the all-moving force of nature."
Still spoke frequently of the visible and the invisible in working with the human body and headed sections of his books with the terms the material and immaterial. In the 19th century, the word immaterial had two meanings. First, that which is not seen or having no form, and second, having no importance. I've chosen to rename the immaterial to non-material in order to prevent any misinterpretation.
Right, because now in the 21st century, when we say the word immaterial, we mean something that doesn't matter, and this matters supremely. So,
exactly.
Thank you for changing the word.
Still was a clinician, a pragmatist, an anatomist, and a vitalist. He believed, or should we say more accurately, he experienced that life was a substance and that material forms coexisted and were motivated by the non-material. And I believe that he could perceive and work with the invisible or non-material clinically. The broad category of what we call material or visible includes all that is objective and can be measured, for example, the palpable anatomy, the detectable physiology, biomechanics, and all that is currently known about the body. The broad category of what we call non-material or invisible include all that is subjective and cannot be measured, for example, subtle functions, inherent motions, bioenergetic elements, and all that is currently unknown. Some of what today we refer to as non-material and is currently unknown will eventually move into the province of the tangible, the physical, the objective, or measurable material field.
Right, because there's some things that are measurable, we just don't have the means of measuring them yet, and technology might give us that. And exactly. There are some things that will forever remain unknown and unknowable, and I love that.
Yes.
My osteopathic teachers always reminded me of the importance of knowing where I was in a patient's body and what I was attending to when I had my hands on someone. I've discovered that a concept from my continuum practice has really helped shed light on this osteopathic situation. In continuum, we call this the three anatomies. I want to clarify the way I'm using the term anatomy here. Anatomy can also mean the study of the inner workings of something. So this is going to be the study of the inner workings of a certain way of describing the material and the non-material. And I'm making three distinctions, not with the intention of separating them, but sometimes if we make a distinction, then we can highlight our ability to move and shift our attention seamlessly between these domains of awareness, which exist concomitantly. So here's a brief introduction to the three anatomies. We're going to be doing a whole episode on this at some point in the future. This will give you an idea there where you can start applying this to your own anatomical, physiologic thinking and the way you approach your patients. The first of the three anatomies we call the personal or the cultural anatomy. We each have a unique experience based on our particular circumstances, like the quirks of my particular body, the circumstances I was born into, factors that include like my family of origin, my culture, my nationality, my acquired beliefs. So our attachment to the narrow views of our lives through a personal lens can distort our perceptions of embodiment. I call this our biography, and although I understand that it's important to make meaning of our individual lives, I've also observed in myself and in my patients that sometimes this attachment to the personal identity can limit the ability to heal or to adapt to health challenges by being overly focused on the personal. So the next of the three anatomies is the biological anatomy. In continuum, we refer to it as the primordial anatomy. The biological anatomy is ruled by the laws of nature. This basic fundamental field is common to all humans, all mammals, and is shared to some extent by all living things. This is the instinctual and the inborn world of inherent biological function. It is the basis of growth, development, healing, adaptability, and change. So when we let go of the constraints of our individual selves, when we yield our biography to our biology, we may access the potential that's available to all of life. The third of the anatomies is the cosmic anatomy. The cosmic is difficult to define because it is not of the material world. It includes all of the influences that are non-material that Steve referred to before. You might call them spiritual, energetic, the unseen forces of nature. This also includes the philosophy of vitalism, which appears in osteopathic philosophy. But the cosmic is not a belief system. The cosmic is not an opinion. The cosmic is not a religion or a spiritual path that's been codified and named. We exist in a universe where the parts are in relationship to the whole, and the whole is unimaginably vast. The cosmic spans the known, the unknown, and the unknowable. If we broaden our awareness and consciously include all three domains, all three anatomies, and we choose which one needs to be tended to, then we can gain access to more possibilities for healing, health, adaptability, and well-being. This expanded awareness could make us more clinically effective osteopaths. Steve spoke before of the necessity of anatomic and perceptual specificity. I'm adding the importance of specificity of awareness in the three anatomies. The biologic field is the most common area where osteopaths tend to treat, where we're thinking about the rules of nature that govern the way all bodies work. Many osteopaths, and particularly many psychotherapists, have a focused interest in treating the personal anatomy. Then people who are more energetically oriented tend to hover at the cosmic end of the spectrum. What's interesting is that it's common for practitioners to have a preference for one of these three domains of awareness. And what I'm proposing is that you can expand, even if you have a preference, you can expand your awareness to include all three domains of the three anatomies. I think one of the things that Steve and I share in our osteopathic worldview is that we have both worked really hard to learn how to seamlessly shift domains to meet the necessity of the moment. Steve, why don't you tell us about the ninth concept, the one that talks about cause and effect?
Osteopathic diagnosis and treatment works to discover the cause of disease, injury, or illness, rather than just treating the effects or dysfunctional compensations. Layers of cause and effect may be present, creating interconnected dysfunctions that lead to complicated clinical presentations. Cause may not always be objectively known, but it is important to explore creative diagnostic possibilities. I'm going to give you one of my favorite all-time A.T. Still quotes. I consider this passage to be in the top five great quotes of all time.
Oh, tell us, please.
Still said, and I quote, "I want it understood that I look upon treating of effects as being as unwarranted as it would be for the firemen of a city to fight the smoke and pay no attention to the cause that produces it."
Well, I have a great example of cause and effect that'll illustrate that in a real life situation. Many years ago, I treated a man who had recurring sciatica. He was a computer programmer at IBM, and he sat at a desk all day. And he came to me several times for treatment, and my treatment seemed to only offer him brief relief. I started to notice that the treatments he responded the best to were the ones that happened on Friday afternoons, and I realized I was taking a little bit too much credit for those treatments because the variable that was different was that he got to go home and rest all weekend. So I realized I had been treating the smoke and I had not yet found the source of his fire. So when I examined him, I sensed that there was severe compression in his lumbosacral spine. And I surmised from that his intervertebral discs were also compressed and dehydrated. So this is a very common cause of disc compression. I suggested to him that he bring a pitcher of water to work, fill it in the morning and fill it at lunchtime and just sip all day on water, which would force him to do two things. It forced him to get up once or twice an hour to urinate so he got to move around, and it caused him to be well hydrated. So if the effects of gravity were going to be compressing and dehydrating his discs, at least he had a chance to move and get some fluids back into that space. So it was interesting, over the course of several months, he stopped coming to me. I think we found the fire, and he was empowered to treat himself, and he got better. But then what happened was he lost his job, and he had to take on a new job. And in his new job, he was doing various on-site consulting jobs, which required that he get in his car and drive from job to job. So he was driving, sitting in the car. His car seat was much worse than his seat in his old IBM office, and it was inconvenient for him to be drinking water all day. So his sciatica returned one day with a vengeance, and he called and begged to be seen on a Friday afternoon. So I squeezed him in for an emergency spot in between some other patients and told him I would just check him out. He was really desperate for a treatment, but I really had no time. I had a waiting room full of people, so I actually proposed an interesting experiment to him. I asked if he were willing to go home, drink a few glasses of water, get a good night's sleep, and call me in the morning. And if he were still suffering in the morning, I would come in and treat him on my day off. But guess what happened? He called me in the morning, and he told me he was 100% better. He was finally convinced that he had found the best treatment for his aging spine, Water with a combination of movement and rest, that's what put out the fire. So Steve, how did you learn the lesson of cause and effect?
So where I learned this was in my first year of practice in 1988. I had just completed my family medicine residency. I was practicing in a small town in Northern California, Watsonville, and I had a very busy family practice. Let me lay out the scenario regarding my office. I had an office manager, I had a nurse, and I worked out of 3 exam rooms. Most of the time, the nurse would then bring patients to the exam room, and I would just move from exam room to exam room, seeing patients. So this one individual was a 40-year-old farmer who came in complaining of headaches. I examined him, determined that an osteopathic treatment would be beneficial. I treated him osteopathically. He got off of the table. His headaches were completely gone. I said to him, "Joe, things look pretty good here. Why don't you come back whenever you need to?" The next week, he was on my schedule again. Same thing. I evaluated him, treated him osteopathically. He stood up off the table, headaches completely gone. So again, I said, "I think this is a simple biomechanical problem. Let's see if this does the trick and come back if they return." The next week, he's back in my office. This time, I see him walking in the hallway, and I usher him back into the room, and he's limping. And I ask him, "Do you still have headaches?" He said, "They're as bad as ever." I said, "Why are you limping?" He said, "I have an infected toe." I said, "Take off your shoe, take off your sock, let me take a look at it." And it turned out he had an ingrown toenail that had a cellulitis and was infected. So what I did was I surgically removed a small sliver of the ingrown toenail, ablated the nail bed, gave him a prescription for antibiotics. I did not treat him osteopathically, and then told him to come back in 2 days for me to check the toe. He comes back 2 days later. He's not limping. He has no headache. I had him come back in another 7 days to check the infection because it was a bad infection. The toe looked great. The infection was gone, and he did not have a resumption of his headaches. What this story taught me was many things. The fire was his infected toe, which then caused him to limp, and the limp caused a chain reaction of compensation all the way up to his neck and his head, which caused tension headaches. And I think it's important for us all to remember that osteopathic manipulation is not the treatment of choice for every medical condition.
Although I'm sure your treatment helped with tissue changes and may have improved healing, but ultimately, if you hadn't gotten rid of the infected toe, the rest wouldn't have gotten better.
Right, and I was just treating the smoke. The headache was smoke, not fire.
Right.
The goal of the osteopath is to find the cause, but there are causes that don't always need an osteopathic treatment.
Right.
And in this case, he needed surgery and antibiotics.
Right.
But I was a young physician, and it means that I did not do a complete physical examination.
Right.
That included a gait evaluation.
Right. So I think this is a great segue into our last but not least, our 10th concept, philosophical concept, the issue of pain. Steve, tell us about it.
Pain is an effect and a symptom, not a disease. If pain is exclusively treated and there is a failure to arrive at the origins of what is causing pain, then the therapeutic actions are limited. The causes of pain are often distant from the symptoms.
So in some ways, this might sound like a variation on the smoke fire issue, and it is, but pain is just so ubiquitous, we decided it needed its own category. And it will have its own episode at some point in the future. Andrew Taylor still had some things to say about pain, and I quote, "We say disease when we should say effect, for disease is the effect of a change in the parts of the physical body." Let's reword this quote to make it more applicable to the concept of pain in an osteopathic context. We say pain when we should say effect, for pain is the effect of a change in the parts of the human body. I have so much to say about pain. Let me start with, pain is not a sensation. I'm going to pause here because this bold statement often throws people off. Pain is not a sensation. Pain is an interpretation of a wide variety of sensations. Our brain and other aspects of our nervous system interpret sensory information, and there's so much individual variation of the conclusion that we draw about what we're feeling based on our emotional state, our past history. Our nutritional or our sleep status will affect our perception of pain and the context that the pain is happening in. So I think the best example of that is the pain of childbirth. If you felt the pain of childbirth suddenly one day while you were sitting at your desk at work, it would be intolerable and you would probably panic and call 911 to get an ambulance. I can't tell you how many women I've known who swore within hours or days of giving birth that they would never give birth again. It was just too painful. You all know what happens. They forget, or it's a trick of evolutionary retrograde amnesia that women give birth multiple times, not remembering and anticipating how painful it will be. The context allows them to bear it and interpret it. Another great example of how the context of pain changes our experience and interpretation of it is what happens when you run a marathon. So any of our listeners who've run a marathon know that it's frequent to have leg pain at some point during a race, especially if you're an elite athlete. If this same pain woke you up from a deep sleep in the middle of the night, you would interpret it quite differently. So something that you might tolerate as just an intense sensation during a marathon, you would call a horrendous pain if it woke you up in the middle of the night. I could go on and on, but I'm going to save that for future episodes.
So often, with respect to the cause of an illness or the cause of pain, the osteopathic diagnosis and treatment will get close enough. It's as if we are firefighters spraying water at the smoke. But the smoke is very close to the fire, and close is good enough. Or to put another way, we may not be able to identify the cause of an illness exactly, but we're close enough, and the patient's natural therapeutic processes put out the fire. Or the osteopathic treatment just opens up the walls, allowing the body's inherent firefighter to finally put out the fire. So let me end the discussion of this 10th principle by being very clear and succinct. Pain is smoke. Pain is not disease. An osteopath is not a pain doctor or a pain clinician. Fire is the cause. An osteopath is a firefighter seeking the heat of cause. In conclusion, I am proud and honored to be an osteopath. These 10 concepts demonstrate our distinctiveness as a healthcare profession and shows the world that osteopathic medicine can and should stand side by side with all of the great healing professions.
It's our hope that by presenting an expanded version of osteopathic philosophy, that every osteopath throughout the world will contemplate these 10 concepts and deepen their individual practices of osteopathy. This is our gift to the osteopathic profession. Stay tuned for our next episode, and we'll be exploring the osteopathic principles of treatment. Thank you for listening to Osteopathy Unplugged. We have created a collection of foundational episodes free of charge. These teachings will provide an introduction to osteopathic clinical philosophy and are available wherever you get your podcasts.
The ongoing collection of Osteopathy Unplugged will be released at regular intervals and will only be available by subscription at patreon.com/osteopathyunplugged. And remember to share our podcast with a friend or colleague.
A special thanks to Corey Blake for composing our theme music.
We would love to hear from you. Please post comments or questions on our Facebook page or on our Patreon homepage. We trust that upcoming episodes will address your burning questions.
Until next time, be well, listen deeply, and stay curious.